I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I'm the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, not say it to now.
I'm down to Anfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
I feel like we're still very much in the getting to know you phase when it comes to Patrice Evra and his football punditry. But we know enough already to know that when Patrice leans back in his chair, fixes his tie, and says something like, "I will tell you a quick story," it's probably not the time to head off and make a cup of tea. Just stay in your seat. Things are going to get pretty juicy pretty quickly. Welcome to Monday Second Captains Football Podcast. Hi, Ken.
Owen, how are you?
Hi, Murph.
Hey, Owen. How's it going?
It's all right. You're enjoying Patrice?
Yeah, I mean, if, you know, retelling private conversations among friends is the sort of thing that, you know, you look for in a pundit, and sometimes those private conversations are absolutely fine, and you feel sure that the other person involved in this private conversation is absolutely fine with you telling the story, and that's great. And then there are other times where you're like, I'm not entirely sure that was for public consumption, but hey, let's go with it. That's what Patrice Evra's punditry style is. You
let's
know,
go with
tell
it.
The story that's and be down. Let's deal with the consequences later. Right now, the thing that's in my head, I'm going to come right out and say it. And, you know, if there are consequences, I'll face them.
We'll talk about Evra in the report on sport and with Dion Fanning and John Bruin. We'll also reflect on the sad news about Gerard Houllier, the former Liverpool, Aston Villa and France manager, has died aged 73. We'll talk in particular about his legacy at Liverpool. As regards the football of the weekend, there were one or two duds in the Premier League, the Manchester Derby in particular, let's be honest. But the great thing about December is you don't have to wait too long for those matches to be knocked out of your memory banks. Full round of games coming up in the Premier League during the week, and we'll be covering it all of it on the World Service. Also on the World Service tomorrow, Jamie Wall and Michael Deignan, who've been getting a lot of plaudits from our members for their analysis this championship, they'll be on to talk about Limerick's ascension to one of the great hurling teams with their second All-Ireland title in 3 years after 45 years of a wait between their previous one and the one 3 years ago, a couple of years ago, if you're following me. Anyway, yeah, that's tomorrow. Let's report on some. Yeah, you're there, man.
Limerick win and could win again.
Yeah, that's continue to win.
I'm afraid they will continue to win on. But yes, Jamie and Michael will take care of it.
When do we start hating Limerick? That's going to be the question on tomorrow's podcast. I think some people are already starting to get there now, so we'll get to that. Ken, please report on some sport. And we might start, Ken, with that news about Gerard Houllier, who had a heart operation. Had a recent heart operation. He obviously has had heart problems dating back to his time at Liverpool. He also had health issues in Aston Villa when he was managing Aston Villa. And you know, really sad news that he has passed away. What kind of a figure do we look back at now in terms of his time at Liverpool? What do you think of when I ask you about Gerard Houllier?
Well, I think that health problem that he had, which was a dissection of the descending aorta, a very serious and often fatal problem, which I think he said that if it had happened, it happened during a game against Leeds at Anfield, where he essentially didn't reemerge for the second half, and it became apparent after the game that he'd been taken to hospital after complaining of problems at half time. That if it had happened at full time rather than coming into half time, he wouldn't have made it because the ambulance wouldn't have been able to get him to the hospital through the traffic in time. So that was a real, I think it was an 11-hour operation. And after that, he was out then for a few months. You might remember that he made this dramatic return to action when Liverpool played Roma in the Champions League. It was Fabio Capello.
That's what I remember more than anything else. Funny enough, when the news came through today and I was thinking back to his health problems at Liverpool, it was his triumphant sort of return. I mean, you know, not that he was 100% healthy on that, you know, he was just finding his feet again, I think, you know, but it was a seriously emotional night that night, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was kind of very characteristic of Houllier to do that, because it was a real theatrical sort of a gesture from him. Like, there's no way he should have done that. Absolutely no way that he was really in any condition to be doing that sort of stuff. Arriving back into, you know, the tumult of Anfield, you know, on this huge night to sort of sit through this very stressful Champions League game with the results. A lot is riding on the result, and it went their way that night. But it was a typically Houllier gesture in terms of he was a guy with a sense of theatre. He certainly was a guy who had his eye on the audience at all times. And you know, if you think about his time at I think it was just shortly after that Roma game that he made this very portentous prediction. This team is 10 games from greatness. It was almost like scripted to sound like a prophecy. You know what I mean? And then it would come true, and everyone would go, "Oh, you predicted it."
Yeah, that's that. You know that when you're saying that, if you're as bright as Gerard Houllier, you know this is going to be the title of the DVD that will come out as well at the end of the season. You know.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it didn't work out. So in a sense, the Roma. The Roma return was kind of the emotional high point of his time there in one way, but also the beginning, I think, of the decline of his time there, because the first half of his time at Liverpool, which was 1998 to 2004, was a lot more successful than the second half. I mean, when he came in, he arrived with quite a big reputation. He was kind of weirdly an unknown, almost unknown figure, but who had the aura of the French World Cup success, right? He was in some like vaguely understood way. He was sort of in some vague sense the architect of the French World Cup win in 1998. He'd had some role that nobody quite understood, but was sure was pretty important in developing.
Clairefontaine was the buzzword in European football back then.
Yeah. Yeah, and he had been the manager. I mean, he'd been the manager of the French team when they failed to qualify. You know, the famous 17th of November 1993, the Alan McLaughlin night, the most insane night of European qualifying history. That was also the night that Gerard Houllier managed France for the last time, because France got knocked out by Bulgaria, and it was the famous feud that he had with David Ginola. He called Ginola a criminal who has sent an exocet into the heart of French football. Which was a bit much. Certainly, David Ginola felt it was too much.
That's gone on for decades, which is something. You know, yeah, there's an extra poignancy to that now. Anyway, sometimes people just don't get on.
Sometimes they don't get on, and you know, so he came and he had this. It was like nobody really knew who he was, but it was like, well, this guy's good, and of course, there's Arsene Wenger, because a point that Houllier made himself. You know, famously Liverpool won the Champions League the season after he left, and he went into the dressing room and so on. He was sort of hanging around on the night of the victory, but he could say, and a lot of the players who were involved, people like Jamie Carragher, who always speaks really well of Houllier, were like, well, we were delighted to see him because this kind of was his team. And he says, he told Simon Hughes, you know, Simon Hughes, who now works for The Athletic, has done a couple of books on Liverpool, you know, decades in Liverpool's history, and one of them, he interviewed Houllier for one of them, and Houllier said, look, when we won the UEFA Cup in 2001, that helped them to win the Champions League, which sounds like a kind of a self-serving thing to say in one sense, but I do think it's true. Like, I mean, the experience of actually winning a European trophy, considering how absolutely hopeless they'd been in all of the years since their return to Europe. You know, throughout the entire 90s, it's been really bad in Europe. Suddenly they win the UEFA Cup. They beat, remember, it was actually another game against Roma that I remember as being a really significant moment in the development of his team. They went to Rome and beat Roma 2-0. This was the same season that Roma won Serie A. It was a great Roma team of Francesco Totti, Gabriel Batistuta, and Liverpool beat them 2-0 in Rome in one of the UEFA Cup knockout games. And that was like a kind of a, whoa, you know, actually this is kind of a serious team. You know, they're capable of beating really top opposition, which Roma then were. They beat Barcelona, not a vintage Barcelona team, I don't think, in 2001, but they beat them as in the semi-final, not conceding a goal over two legs. And then they eventually won the trophy in the end. And I do think that that did help. I mean, in a similar way, when Julia came, he was kind of, there was the aura of the French World Cup win, but also Wenger's success at Arsenal. Remember, Wenger had just led Arsenal to the double in 97-98. So it was kind of like, oh, French guys. You know, they're just sort of, they know which way the game is going. You know, let's get one of these French guys in. Of course, he was in this weird sort of coaching marriage with Roy Evans, which was just a completely shambolic situation. Like, looking back, one of the most comedic moments, surely, in all of English football history, just because the Liverpool chairman, David Moore, just couldn't bring himself to you know, sack Roy Evans. It was like old Yeller, you know, he just couldn't do it. So he did it after a few months, you know, it didn't work out.
But yeah, the writing was on the wall, I think, once Julia arrived.
Yeah, it was. And so what Julia did was like, he was kind of a very different manager from anyone Liverpool had before. All the previous managers going back to the literally the end of the 1950s had been from the same gene pool. You know what I mean? They'd all been sort of Liverpool football men from the boot room. You know, so there was... some of them had come from the team, like Dalglish and Souness, Joe Fagan, Roy Evans, all of these boot room boys and so on. So he was the first totally new manager from outside, even though he kind of played up his connections to the city quite a lot. And he was also the first, like, I'm also a scientist. Like, maybe I'm not a football man like your Joe Fagans or your Graham Souness's. Maybe... People have said I couldn't kick snow off a rope. Sure, however, I'm also privy to certain secrets of modern coaching, such as it's really bad to drink alcohol all the time, and also footballers should eat vegetables at least occasionally. These types of things. He brought in these types of then revolutionary measures, which of course met with resistance from some of the more reactionary elements. Paul Ince was one guy who he had, who he basically had a big conflict with in the beginning. But he got rid of Paul Ince, actually supported in this, he told Simon Hughes again, by his very good friend Alex Ferguson, who said, kicking out Paul Ince will be the best decision you ever make for your football club, Jared. you will be happier with that decision than anything else you ever do in your career. So the way that he got rid of Ince was again quite characteristic, because Ince was like a big figure in the dressing room, a respected player, you know, England player, the by far the highest status individual as a footballer, considering what he'd done in the game in that dressing room, and looked up to by all the younger players. Not an easy person to take on, you know. Even if you're like, I need to get rid of Ince because he doesn't do what I want. He kind of obviously doesn't respect my authority. He organizes, he's kind of the team's social leader. He's, you know, I'm trying to change things around here. I'm trying to get people to go to bed early and all that kind of stuff. So Julia, this is in the Simon Hughes book, has an interesting story about that. Do you remember the time when Liverpool played Manchester United in the FA Cup? This is the season United won the treble, 98-99. And if you recall, the third round FA Cup game was against Liverpool at Old Trafford, and Liverpool scored a goal through Michael Owen very early in the game.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
And what happened?
Two goals in injury time for Manchester United, including the winner from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, was it? to knock them out.
Ødegaard, Solskjær, or Dwight York. I can't remember the order of those last two goals, but Solskjær and York scored in the last minute to turn 1-0 down into 2-1 up. But a detail which had escaped my memory, but not that of Gerard Houllier, was the way in which Paul Ince, the Liverpool captain, had simply cried off. In the 71st minute, Ince signalled he needed to be substituted. We were close to knocking United out, Houllier remembers. It would have been a huge result for us. They eventually went on to win the treble. Historically, we know how important these moments are. Paul said he had a strain. He walked off the pitch. I thought, wait, you're captain of Liverpool. You're 1-0 up at Old Trafford against your former club. If the captain of Liverpool leaves in that sort of game, he only goes straight to hospital. A few days later, Paul was training again. So he's like, well, you know, there you have the measure of the man. So what happens then, a short while later, is saying to Houllier, you know, I just think the training's off, Gaffer. You know, we need to do more work on attacking. And this is the moment that Houllier's been waiting for us, because Ince has taken him on in front of the team here. What's going to happen? Well, Houllier turns around and says to Ince, you know, Paul, you know those five-a-sides we play in training? And Ince is like, yeah, well, I've been keeping a note on what's happening in those five-a-sides, Paul, and I noticed that you seem to enjoy yourself a lot in those five-a-sides, but it also seems to me that you don't win a lot of those five-a-sides, Paul. Do you know how many of those five-a-sides you've won? And Ince is like, what? And Houllier says, five. You've been in the winning side five times. Or something like this.
Well, out of how many, though? Yeah. That's the question. Have there been 100?
I reminded him in front of the group in the 60 or so five-a-side matches that had taken place in the months before, he'd only been on the winning team something like five times. And that was the end of the discussion. And so this was the... And so this was like typical of Houllier. It was like, hang on, you've been taking notes on training? No one's ever done that before. You've got statistics on like training five-a-sides? What? No one's ever tried that here before. So there were things like that. He did make them into a more serious club. You know, they signed some players. I mean, it's kind of funny reading about it now. Like, you know, they found Sammy Hippier, who went on to be like the bedrock of their defense for 10 years, based on the recommendation of like a cameraman who worked for, I think, like Eurosport and would cover the Dutch league. And was like, hang, does this really, like, I think really good
what
defender.
What did he do? Like ring like the Anfield front desk, get through to the receptionist?
He was talking to Peter Robinson, who was then the sort of club secretary, and he was like, you know, there's this really good defender. I don't understand why like none of the big Dutch clubs have picked him up. And Houllier was like, well, if they haven't picked him up, he obviously is no good. Like, if, you know, if he's playing in Holland and he hasn't been signed by Ajax, Feyenoord, or PSV, then there's no point in me looking at this guy. And he's like, no. Yeah, I think you should take a look. And then they looked at him. They're like, well, actually, he looks really good. We'll get him in. And he, you know, so there was a couple of good signings like this. And they ended up, I mean, I think that he was not a coach, like in the way that Benitez, who replaced him, was, and the way that Klopp is. Houllier was not really a football-oriented football manager, if you know what I mean. He was like he was a manager who was like, I'll bring in a coach to do the ball stuff. You know, my role is more holistic. You know, I make a lot of phone calls. I read the papers. You know, I stand up and what's happening in the papers. And I think that this was reflected in a kind of, as time went on, it was like, what are the ideas behind this team beyond like being a good defensive team that's got like a couple of fast forwards who can score, you know, and plays disciplined sort of football, you know? And I think over time this began to get a bit threadbare. You know, there wasn't really a sense of like, you know, has Michael Owen really improved as a player? Well, if anything, the opposite. You know, for all of the sort of scientific preparation stuff that Houllier was into, he still sort of was the manager who overplayed Owen to the point where his hamstrings exploded. You know,
yeah, and even the Ince stuff, I mean, it's a bit contradictory, because if you're saying on one hand he's a science guy by the measures of the time, and the other hand he's saying that you have to be basically going to hospital if you want to come off injured in
absolutely
a game against Manchester United.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, he'd be prepared to be flexible. He'd play the ball as it came to him, I think, Houllier. I mean, I think he was definitely a kind of he was a sort of a lovey as well. Like, in a sense, the big success they had winning all those trophies was like such a kind of, I mean, he's quite romantic in his outlook. I think he sort of was quite self-consciously at times sort of trying to imitate or trying to be that sort of romantic ideal of, like, you know, the Bill Shankly manager standing in front of the cop, you know, arms raised, you know, sort of taking the acclaim of the people, you know, that sort of thing. Like, I think he had a bit of a weakness for that sort of thing, and was the flip side of that being very intensely sensitive to criticism, which began to come more and more as in the less successful second half. Like that, when he uttered the 10 games from greatness, that all skated off the rails against Bayer Leverkusen. They were against Bayer Leverkusen in the quarterfinal of the Champions League, and Houllier would, I remember they were, it was like, it was a very exciting game. It was one of these kind of, oh, the two teams are scoring a lot of goals. It's a bit chaotic. Berbatov was playing the game. Balak, Lucio, I think, scored the winner in the end for Leverkusen. Litmanen scored a great goal for Liverpool in the game. But it was kind of, it was obviously not a game that the manager was in control of in any sense, apart from when Houllier ran down and said, I've got to take control, whipped off Didi Hamann and sent on Vladimir Smeter. And this was almost like he had just unpinned the entire team. Like, if there was one sort of screw holding this rickety contraption together, like, Houllier had just run down and unscrewed that screw, and the whole thing just collapsed. Hamann has spoken about this before, said, look, it was a very difficult moment for him to come back from, because it was like, it was one of those nights where the players walked off the field going, oh, that one's on you, Gerard. You know, it's hard really for us to see how that decision
as much
sense.
As they might have liked him personally, as it seems like a lot of them did. There comes a point sometimes when players do lose trust in a manager.
Well, I think that's true. And you know, when you look at it, and it never really kind of recovered from that. Like, in they sort of started to let in more goals, and they had, like, he was trying to find a way to what Liverpool did then was a sort of a primitive version of Mourinho ball, like, but without the sophistication that Mourinho was to bring to a similar type of style of play within a couple of years. In fact, around the same time, because Mourinho's first big success was 2002-03, when Houllier was kind of on the down slope at Liverpool. But like, this idea of, you know, we'll be disciplined, we'll stay behind the ball, we won't have too many barriers going forward, we'll use fast counterattacks and stuff. Once teams are clued into what you're doing, they'll say, okay, well, what about we don't give you any space? And then you just start getting lots of nils. And then that's when people start going, oh, this is terrible. Boring games, scarcity of goals equals criticism. And the more it became sort of a vicious cycle, like Houllier's sensitive to criticism, sort of lashing out, becoming more paranoid, the criticism then becoming more intense, everything just sort of spiraling. It just hit one of those spirals. And ultimately, when he left, I think everybody thought, well, everybody apart from Houllier, thought that this was probably... No, this had to happen at that time. But you know, in the end, the team that he left, as he pointed out, was largely the same team that won the Champions League the following season, and the players who were involved, most notably obviously Carragher and Steven Gerrard, both of whom kind of, well, Carragher actually made his debut before Houllier arrived, but Houllier showed a lot of faith in him and really was responsible, I think, for him making it at Liverpool, because he kept playing him, and people were like, this guy, you know, he's not a fullback, he's not a midfielder, what is he? And Houllier kept him in the team when he was getting criticised a lot, and they always speak well of him. So he left behind, I think, in general, a very good impression.
Just the last one, going into the dressing room after the game in Istanbul, I have to be honest, at the time when I heard about that, I thought, that's a bit cringy, you know, like, it's a different manager in there, it's his team now, he's won it, you know, you had these players and you didn't, I was about to say you didn't win anything, that's completely unfair, but you know, it had gone south, you know, and you know the rain finished, so just leave them at it. And maybe I'm just being sort of, I have an overly generous interpretation of it now because of the circumstances we're talking about it, but even just the sort of the self-confidence to go in and not think about the things that I'm just talking about there, not think about how this might be perceived, you know, I don't know how Rafa's going to take this. It's just like, no, sure, I'm at the stadium, I love these guys, I think they'd like me, so I'm going to go in and congratulate them. It doesn't matter. I'm not even going to think about what others might think about it.
Yeah, I mean, everyone was in a good mood, you know, it was one of those. When everyone's in that kind of mood, it's like, oh yeah, you know, that's just, and then maybe only afterwards they might go, well, you know, that maybe that was a bit strange, but like,
I don't think Rafa ever minded though, or certainly Benitez never said anything. Well, he's hardly going to go, you know, say much about it, but he didn't seem to. Who cares who's in the dressing room really when you've just won a Champions League?
Yeah, so I mean, it was sad to hear that news, but there was some memorable times.
What else is Evra? Will we talk about Evra? Or do you want to talk about Arsenal specifically?
Well, the Premier League is now resembling that clip of like the Japanese game show where everyone's dressed as a Power Ranger and they're trying to like climb up this sort of water slide, but everyone's completely covered in oil and so they're just like slipping down, and you know, and everyone's like, "What's good?" So it's just a sequence of humiliations of teams. You know, throwing away points, seasons being blown up. You know, the Manchester Derby is just this pathetic non-game. and then you know, these cowards are getting what they deserve, marooned in mid-table. And then you sort of, then Marcus Crassus's Chelsea lose to Everton, and you're like, well, that's not a great result. And then Tottenham declare at 1-0 up against Crystal Palace, and they've thrown their chance away. And then Liverpool make a complete hames of it against Fulham, even though they get generous VAR decisions. So it's just like, okay, I mean, everyone seems to be doing pretty badly, but then a hero emerged, a champion emerged, a team that separated itself from the pack and was crowned the undisputed kings of comedy. On the weekend, Arsenal Football Club, lad.
Arsenal Football Club, lad.
And did you see the ad? Did you see the Arsenal Adidas ad that came out like over the weekend?
No,
you didn't see
it. Ken.
Oh, it's amazing. You should go and look at it. It's amazing. I think I sent it on to WhatsApp, but obviously you just don't click it.
Oh, Ken, I'm sorry. There was All Ireland Hurling Final was on. Either. Jesus, like, you know, I can't be all things.
All Ireland Hurling Final wasn't on Saturday. Yeah,
but with those WhatsApp ones, sometimes when it just says, you know, if it's just a Twitter link or something, Ken. I'm thinking, well, I sometimes need a couple of words like a lol or something.
Check
that just tells
out,
me.
Check this out, mate. Unbelievable banter.
Yeah.
That sort of thing, Ken.
Just me sending it isn't enough. It's not like, oh, Ken sent this, it might be interesting. No, it's just like,
well, no, I want to know. I want to know what's involved, you know.
Well, it was this amazing ad, but like it's hard for me to describe if you haven't seen. Okay,
I'm gonna check
it's
out
like
WhatsApp
a 3-minute. It's a 3-minute long ad, and it's got that song off the Drive soundtrack. I don't eat, I don't sleep, I do nothing but Under Your Spell. It's called by Desire. So that's the soundtrack, and it's basically just this. A series of Arsenal players from the men's and women's team from days gone by, from 1990, because it's sort of got a 1990 theme. So you've got like a kind of a cartoon, David Seaman and Steve Bould. Steve Bould, who's got like cool hair in it, driving in a convertible sort of through the sky. Over. I mean, it's hard to describe.
You didn't send that to us. You didn't send it on. I knew that I'd watch it.
Aubameyang is like this game show host. It's like some kind of generation game thing going on. They've got Danielle van der Donk in it. Vivian Miedema. They've got Thomas Partey. They've got that like conveyor belt of prizes. Hector Bellerin on Blind Date. The whole thing looks, sounds, feels great. What does it mean? I don't know. I just know that I watched it and I liked it. But also the problem with doing this kind of thing and then losing it home to Burnley is tweets like the one from Old Firm Fact saying, did you know retro sportswear brand Arsenal has its own football club, which actually beat professional side Sheffield United in October 2020. So Arsenal are now on this incredible run of like two goals in 8 matches or something, and they're just losing
to
everybody.
Say, right, I was watching the game last night, and I did think that the tracksuit top that they were wearing when they came out for the before the game started was one of the coolest things I've ever seen being worn by a football team.
I'm pretty sure they're wearing it like both the modern day Ian Wright and the Irishman 1990 Ian Wright, who are sitting there watching Ian Wright goals together on TV. I mean, come on, like you have to watch this ad. But unfortunately, the football is just a really depressing contrast with like the content that Arsenal are producing these days. I saw a tweet from Adam Crafton. He says, Steve Round, assistant to McLaren with England, Allardyce at Newcastle, Moyes at Manchester United, and Arteta at Arsenal could sell a remarkable autobiography one day. That is one way to put it. Adam Crafton adds, he did have very good periods under Jim Smith at Derby, McLaren at Borough, and Moyes at Everton, it should be said. So this Forrest Gump of disaster has just been
Zelig. Disaster Zelig.
Oh my God, how can one guy have seen so much pain? He's borne witness to a lot of pain. I mean, it's bad at Arsenal. It's bad. I mean, how bad? Let's hear from one of the many voices of the Arsenal fans these days, George Watts at G Watts Rants.
I've had enough Burnley losing 1-0 at home. I'm sick of it, Arteta. I've defended you, but you've got to go. There's the door, Tala. Honestly, Xhaka, go, leave. Look what you're doing to me. I'm sick of it. We're losing 1-0, we're passing it round the back. Aubameyang, we sacked 50 staff to pay for your new contract, and what do? Nothing. But the blame just ain't on you. Arteta, you have got to go. I've backed you till the cows come home, but now is enough. 5 points off the relegation zone. Losing to Burnley.
So that's George Watts. I've defended you. I've backed you. Thanks, mate.
Thanks for your valuable backing up until this point.
But the problem with your like Twitter handle again at G Watts Rants is once you're there, where can you go from there? Like, there's nowhere to go. You can't physically scream any louder. Your voice cannot become any more of a ragged, high pitched shriek without like completely just disappearing off the vocal register.
I mean, he didn't
rend
his garments. I mean, everything else is there. I suppose the next thing is for him to just start shredding his own clothes, pulling out his own teeth, perhaps. I mean,
well,
if he pulled out
his
own teeth,
that's
then I'd be like, okay, this man actually cares. Up until then, I'm kind of like, well, don't you think, George, this is maybe a little performative? You know,
this is come on, George. You know, how do we know? You know, if show don't tell. Right? You know, like I mean, you've still got quite a lot of clumps of your own hair attached to your head that haven't been torn out yet. Like I mean, you know, what's going on here? You know, how are we going to know you really care? And like this is the problem. This emotional hyperinflation is a massive problem for the sort of pundit sphere, and I don't know if like fashion is going to take care of it, like if it's just going to become this, like maybe this Ingmar Bergman sort of vibe from Arsenal post-match analysis, where like nobody, people sit there and don't say anything like for hours at a time, or like
just stare at a window.
You know, it's just like this cold, like this married couple on a long train journey, just not speaking to each other. Like maybe that's going to be. They're going to have to take it in some sort of direction like that to get across the utter alienation of Arsenal, because just screaming is. But it poses a problem, you would think, also for the studio super fans who are increasingly are different from the sort of internet ones, and in that like they don't swear as much and they get paid a lot more. But they do have one trick up their sleeve that at George Watts Rants doesn't have, which is they haven't spent a long time hanging out with the unsuspecting Thierry Henry, and they've got a few stories to tell. Take it away, Patrice Evra.
We're talking about Saka. I will tell you a quick story. Thierry Henry one day invited me to his house. He said, "Come, Patrice, we're going to even watch the Arsenal game." He turned on the TV. The first image we saw on the screen, it was Saka leading Arsenal team, being the captain. Thierry Henry turned off the TV. I said, "What's happened?" He said, "I can't watch my team and Saka being the captain of my team." And we didn't watch the game. We start talking about many things. And he turned off the screen. He tell you everything about what the legend of even this club think about him. And he, again, let down his team. Like, we criticize Pepe so much, but Saka is not the first time. I remember even 2 years ago, I made a comment about Arsenal saying they still look like babies, and he come out. Patrice Evra is not the first time he spoke about us. And I remember he gets substituted or he get off, and he take off his shirt and he throw it on the floor. So we had enough of Saka. I think Arsenal fan had enough of him.
Well, Thierry's not here to confirm that story.
He will, trust me. I'm not a liar.
So maybe we just have to be a little bit careful with that.
Can you imagine how pissed off Thierry Henry is with that? Like, Thierry Henry, the most relentlessly equivocating, triangulating bot you've ever seen doing TV punditry. Have you ever seen anyone more adept at, like, sitting on the fence? He's like the Cirque du Soleil of... Oh, it doesn't matter what angle the fence comes at him. He can just find a way to just perch. And here's Evra telling this story, which I have to say, right? Do you think that story sounds true?
It's I don't know Thierry Henry well enough to know. I would certainly think it sounds
it sounds
plausible.
To me like it could have happened.
You're saying it sounds Owen, that it sounds truthy.
It's got an element of something that may have happened.
Yeah, I could see Thierry Henry turning the game back on after say 20 minutes. You know, like he turned off, like, I'm disgusted.
Maybe,
let's just, you know, let's eat, let's have our dinner, and then maybe we'll turn the football back on with the volume down or something.
What I find remarkable about it, Murphy, is the level of surprise that Thierry Henry had.
You know, it seems like he's out of nowhere.
Jack, what the fuck? What's going on here?
It doesn't make sense. Thierry, mate, like he's been the captain for, like, you know, he's the captain for ages, like elected by his peers. You know, how is Henri surprised to see that Xhaka was leading the team out? Xhaka's the captain. You know, was he just turning on every Arsenal game and then just turning back off again in disgust when he saw Xhaka was captain? Like, it's nonsense. And it's like, are we seriously to believe that Henri was so outraged that Xhaka was the captain that he can't even watch the game that he's invited Evra over to supposedly watch? Like, this is just, not even George Watts
is
going to
do
that.
Yeah, well, you know, like, maybe the takeaway arrived, you know, and Henri was just like, let's just get this out on plates first, you know, and we'll pour a glass of wine, we'll have, like, how's the wife? Grand, no problem. And then turns it on, you know, after a short spell. Maybe they missed the first 10 minutes. I mean, if Thierry Henry turned off the television, got the takeaway, put it out on plates, plus the spring rolls as well, of course, the starters, poured themselves a glass of wine, and then turned the television back on after 10 minutes, would you say that Patrice Evra's story was a lie or the truth? I mean, I would say that is the truth. Like, Patrice Evra told the truth there, even though maybe, you know, there...
Maybe he told the capital T truth, even if the small t truth there may have been a couple of facts which he were sort of swept imperiously aside by Patrice Evra's drive towards a greater narrative truth. Yeah. Well, that may also be true. We may have got sidetracked down the boring cul-de-sac here. Is this story even true? When obviously the more salient point is, how did Patrice Evra think that it's okay to tell that story? I mean, I honestly can't believe it. Like, what a withering story that is. This is about, like, Thierry Henry is arguably the greatest player in the history of Arsenal. You know, he's definitely one of their best players. He's the iconic player of the last 30 years, you could say. I mean, there have been a couple of others, Bergkamp and Vieira, the others who sort of approach his status. But Henry is the biggest Arsenal playing legend going. And for him to apparently have been so disgusted by the sight of Xhaka representing Arsenal that he turns off the television. I mean, that's just...
You don't recover from that one straight away if you're a granite Xhaka, right? That is fair.
But I also certainly don't remember Thierry Henry ever saying anything like that when he was working on Sky. He wasn't given to these types of...
Thierry Henry's, you know, Thierry Henry, and Patrice Evra is Patrice Evra, right? You know, if Patrice Evra, you know, behaved as Thierry Henry did as a pundit, we wouldn't be seeing a whole pile of Patrice Evra. Let's be honest.
I'm just amazed you can focus on any football. If you're sitting down in private with Patrice Evra, I'm amazed you're able to focus on watching any football, because judging by the stories he tells in public, I can only imagine what kind of stuff he's coming out with in a private chat. Very hard to focus on the football.
Although, does he have... He does speak as though he doesn't sort of recognise any distinction between sort of public and private, like as though he's just sort of like, hey, you know, I just say what's on my mind, you know, why I don't need a second face, you know, I don't need to put on a mask to go on television. I'm just the same guy the whole time. I mean, I don't know. It wasn't even the only bad thing that he said about Xhaka. I mean, that was the Henry thing. It was obviously by far the most withering thing. But he also said this about Xhaka, which is amazing. Throwing in the phrase, I have nothing against this player, by the way, I just think elevates this little clip.
I have nothing against this player, but I'm sorry. It's time for him to say, you know what, guys? I've done enough here. I'm hurting the fan. I'm hurting my teammate. I'm hurting the manager. Let me go away.
So, according to Evra, Xhaka essentially should just accept that he is like Captain Oates or something, you know, like in the Antarctic, and just sort of recuse himself from the team and, like, shuffle away into the oblivion. It's just like, I've never heard anyone suggest this before. Like, can he seriously think that? I mean, he's saying it on TV that he thinks Granit Xhaka needs to just literally, like, consign himself to the dustbin of history just out of sheer mortification and how bad he is. I don't think Xhaka is a good player. I mean, you know, I mean...
It's not just the quality of play. It's I think more this is in the light of the stupidity of getting sent off,
yeah,
like right in front of the ref. Something has already developed. It's the kind of one where he grabs another player's throat. In the modern day, that's a red card.
And you
should certainly know it's a red card. And the referee has already been alerted to the ongoing situation and is standing staring at you from about a foot away.
It's just so. The whole thing was just so stupid. You know, like the guy's got McNeil's going past him, like. There's no need to foul him. There's Arsenal players around. It's so clumsy to foul. It's that you're looking at it going, oh my God, like Xhaka has injured himself. You know, it looked like the serious risk to Xhaka of injuring himself by the foul, so clumsy it is. And then he just gets involved in this and you're like, oh my God. Like, and then he's going off. And the thing about Xhaka is you can see that it actually does mean a lot to him. You know what I mean? It's not like he's walking off going, I don't care. He's like a broken, devastated figure.
Not for the first time.
Not for the first time. We've seen it so many times. But like, you just can't keep doing this. Like, I mean, you can't. But you know, Arteta keeps picking the guy again. The last time something spectacular like that happened, Emery was the manager. You know, when ever referred obviously to that incident, you know, dredging that one up again, he thought it was longer ago than it was. I mean, Xhaka, I saw him play against Ireland for Switzerland and he looked like a good player in that game. You know, I'm not saying the guy's not a decent footballer. I just don't think he's a top Premier League midfielder, really. And Arsenal have been kind of trying to pretend that he is for, I think, long enough at this stage. Probably it might be time to try something else. But look, I mean... it's hard to know what to say about it. How can it be this bad? One thing I have seen a bit of over the last few days is this idea that, well, the Wenger Ed Brigade, the Wenger Ed Brigade really should, well, what do they think of this now?
Is it, you know, that's what you heard?
Or like,
it's tiny.
Yeah, well, just it's that general, just that general sort of, you know, well, where's the Wenger Ed Brigade now? You don't hear much from Wenger Ed Brigade now, do you? And,
well, this
and,
is what you asked. Quote, this is what you asked for, Wenger Ed Brigade, that sort of thing. Yeah,
this is it. This is what. Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, maybe he wasn't doing such a bad job after all. And I saw a quote also from Wenger attributed to Wenger. Now again, I don't remember when Wenger said this alleged quote, but the quote said, "When you have eaten caviar for a long time, it is difficult to go back to sausages." And I thought, nah, disagree. With respect. Respectfully disagree.
You would hear a bad word said against sausages, you know, when you can.
Well, sausage, I mean, everybody knows sausages are good and caviar is overrated. We know this. But it's not even about the specific foods. I mean, he could have said, you know, if you've eaten nothing but, like, you know, watermelon slices, it's difficult to go back to fried eggs. You know, the point is that it's wrong. The whole logic of it is wrong. The way that we are, the way that we're made, as you might say, Kieran, as humans, the way that we are made is... is that
there should be a balance in all things. You don't want to be eating the same thing all the time, Kitcher. It's mad, crazy.
Exactly. Exactly. Anything. Caviar. Can you imagine anything worse than eating caviar for like 18
horrendous.
Years or however long Wenger was there? 18 years. No. After that, you'd be desperate for anything. You would eat shite off a scabby leg, as my mother's charming phrase.
What? Your mother has that phrase.
It's a phrase, Owen, that haunted my childhood. What are we having for dinner, man? Shite on a scabby leg.
It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein.
Can we get some ketchup with that?
All I'm saying is that is that's what you would go for, and that indeed is what Arsenal arguably are gobbling down at the moment. You know, it's hungry days. It is the time of famine at the Emirates. It's not good. You know, people saying Ozil should come back. There's another Wenger quote about how, with Ozil, the guy's an artist. You have to give those guys, you know, latitude. I'm like, no, you don't. Not anymore. Like, I mean, it's just, you know, the guy.
Yeah, we'll talk about Ozil with the two guys.
Next up for Arsenal, it's Ralphie Hasenhüttl, Southampton, who are going to absolutely, I would imagine, destroy them. I mean, Shea Adams back in the goal trail. Have you ever noticed how meaty Shea Adams' thighs are?
I have.
They are massive.
He's an extremely well-built gentleman. I mean, he's all there.
He looks like a front row rugby player. Just in the tie area. So that's what's next up for Arsenal. Shea Adams and Danny Ings and the rest of Ralphie's pressing machine. I'm sure it's going to be good. Should we just mention the Champions League draw?
Go for it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, the Champions League draw. And you haven't heard it yet, Owen, have you? You haven't heard it?
I have not, Kenneth. This might sound ridiculous to people listening to this at, say, you know, I don't know, 6 in the evening, but we're talking a little earlier in the day and it's just been made. I have yet to see it.
Well, I'll give you, it's from, Liverpool against Red Bull Leipzig. So that's a bit of a derby game there, in a sense. Mm. Man City against Borussia Mönchengladbach. So another Anglo-German tie. Madrid. Atletico Madrid against Chelsea. Now that's an interesting one. Porto against Juventus. No. Perhaps so interesting, although Ronaldo gets to Portugal, I suppose. Lazio against Bayern, Sevilla against Dortmund, Atalanta versus Real Madrid, and Barcelona versus Paris Saint-Germain. A lot of... hopefully Neymar is fit for that. He had a bad injury over the weekend. I don't know if you saw, he was injured his ankle again, his troublesome ankle, injured in a tackle. So hopefully he's back to play against Barcelona in late February, assuming this all is going ahead and hasn't all just been wiped off the slate by some other unforeseen disaster.
They are the champions. They have taken the title away from Manchester United and they have done it here at Old Trafford. It does not get more conclusive.
It's very difficult to see Arsenal play one day without Arsenal on the bench.
He's going to ruin the club, fam. He's going to ruin the club, lad. I'm telling you, fam.
Up and down the land, you do sense a genuine appreciation for the way this Arsenal team play. They were perfect.
It's turning. It's turning, blood. Did you hear the booze at full time? Seriously, shut the fuck up tonight. I'm not in no mood for no little dickheads chatting shit.
Love to have him there all the time, but we all know that's not going to happen. One day he's going to have to go.
Spineless, where were they in the second half? Spineless, no fucking character, no fucking leadership. Where does that boil down to? It boils down to the fucking manager. He's finished.
It will be hard. He's not thinking of leaving one day.
He was a great manager. He's gone. He's gone.
It will happen eventually, we all know it, but I don't see it.
Arsenal Football Club, lad.
For me, the day I will see Arsenal play without Arsene on the bench, it's going to be weird.
The fan base of this fucking club are happy to be full.
Don't try to question my fan base. Don't try to question my fan base, okay?
The fan base, listen. I can't get angry like I did before because it's just.
Arsene Wenger's team, every bit as good as the manager's words. He had no doubts. They are the champions. They have taken the title away from Manchester United and they have done it here at Old Trafford. It does not get more conclusive than that.
Dion Fanning and John Bruin are on to talk about the weekend's football, but guys, I have to first of all obviously ask about Gerard Houllier, the sad news that Gerard Houllier has died. I saw Gary Lineker tweeting, one of football's smartest, warmest and loveliest people. Dion, if we can start with you, what sort of it's obviously the Liverpool connection is what everyone thinks of. He did also manage Villa and he's been involved in football his whole life. A lot of kind of interesting roles and maybe an interesting legacy above and beyond just Liverpool. But that's what's in people's heads, certainly in my head when I think of him. What is his legacy at Liverpool?
I think his legacy is huge because
especially in the first 3 years at the club, because when you look at the club he came into and what he did for a club that was just unable to let go of the past, really. Like, there was, you know, or else, you know, you had the kind of Graeme Souness era, which was like, I'm actually just going to go to war with the past and knock down the boot room and this kind of stuff. Whereas Houllier provided a direction for the club in terms of how it needed to modernise. And, you know, you look at the Roy, like the talent that was available to the previous manager, the Roy Evans era, and even then the how reluctant Liverpool were to let go of things, that the, you know, the initial way Houllier came in was as joint manager with Roy Evans, because that was the way the club felt they could weld the past and the future together. And there was only ever going, from that, you know, there was only ever going to be one winner in that, and it spoke to the kind of lack of ruthlessness in other areas of the club. But Houllier, on the other hand, knew exactly what he wanted. I think it turned over the years. I think probably, you know, after 2001, 2002, like it was tougher for him, and he became very welded to a very elemental, fundamental style of football. But I do think, again, you know, what Jamie Carragher said about him and Benitez, about, you know, what being manager of Liverpool does to you. You know, I saw one man walking in the door and another man walking out the door. And it was an all-consuming job. But I think what he did in those years was hugely significant, and also brought great, you know, the treble in 2001. That was, at that stage, it was an exceptional triumph for Liverpool. Like, it was, you know, obviously Manchester United were winning leagues and winning European Cups at that point, but to win the FA Cup the way they did against Arsenal in Cardiff, and then to go on, I think it was the following Wednesday, then they went to Dortmund and won the UEFA Cup. So, like, that was huge in terms of creating the platform for Liverpool to sort of move away from the 1970s and 1980s.
Yeah, I think it's really well put. And I do remember when Liverpool won the league this year, and there were a lot of pieces being written about the title drought, the Premier League title drought, and everything that went in the years, in the decades in between. But reading it was almost hilarious to see it as a drought, because there were a lot of high moments, and there was success, and there was interesting stuff going on at Liverpool for most of those years in between winning the old First Division and then finally winning the Premier League last season. John, what about Houllier's role? What are your memories of him?
Houllier always struck me as a guy with whom he was very well connected in football. He and Alex Ferguson got on pretty well. In fact, Eric Cantona's arrival in English football and subsequently at Manchester United had a lot to do with Gerard Houllier. So Manchester United fans have certainly a big thing to be thankful to Gerard Houllier for. Dion mentioned that parochial side of Liverpool. Houllier was the correct fit for the club at the time. Okay, you had that fudge over the two managers because he had lived in Liverpool, of course. He'd been a teacher in Liverpool. And he actually spoke English, didn't he, with a slight Scouse accent, because that's obviously where he learned to become properly fluent in English. And for Liverpool to progress, they almost had to find an outsider who knew what it was to be an insider, who knew what it was to be from Liverpool, to be part of the city. And obviously, it was a different appointment to the one of Rafa Benitez, but Rafa Benitez was a guy that came completely from the outside. So did Jurgen Klopp, and that's when the club changed. But Houllier should be seen as a key figure in Liverpool's history, and someone who did deliver success. And he delivered success at a time when Manchester United were probably at their Ferguson era peak, and Arsenal were at the Wenger era peak. So to deliver it's 5 trophies in 1 year, that represents great success, actually, when you look back on it. Obviously, Liverpool never really went close enough to winning a title, and there were certainly regrets on the way out for Houllier. And of course, when Liverpool did win the Champions League in 2005, Benitez pretty much did it with a team of Houllier players. And there was that sort of famous scene, wasn't there, of Houllier going into the dressing room after the game to congratulate everybody. And, you know, he'd been the boss just 12 months before. So I think as time has gone on, Liverpool fans have certainly looked back on Houllier as someone who was good for the club. And well, it's sad news because we use that phrase "football man," and Gerard Houllier was definitely one of them.
Yeah, well put. We will talk now about the football itself this weekend because it was a strange kind of a weekend, Dion, with none of the big six winning. But can we officially say now, as suggested by a listener last week, can we officially say that Arsenal should not really be considered in the big six at the moment?
Yeah, I think that's probably valid because otherwise that stat is never going to have any use whatsoever for the rest of the season.
Yeah, so Preston North End or someone should be in the big six based on something that happened decades ago. But they do seem so far off. Like how much of a crisis is this that they're in now, do you think?
I think it's an exceptional crisis. I think it's, again... the idea, if the Emirates had been full or half full, or even a quarter full, I think there would have been a sense of the huge pressure Arteta would be under now, because it's as bad a situation, obviously, as Arsenal, that they're in a relegation battle. Like that hasn't happened. So it's extreme, and I think the problem is looking at it and wondering, right, what is Arteta aiming for? What is he, what power and what control does he have over the elements of the club that he needs to kind of take hold of, first of all, and then what is he aiming for with control, if he finally takes control properly? Because you can't build a club on just not picking Mesut Ozil.
Well, one thing he is supposed to have control over is the discipline of his players, and yet he doesn't seem to. John, once again, he calls this unacceptable by Granit Xhaka, which I guess most people would agree with. But he said the same thing just a few weeks ago with Pepe. So it doesn't sound like they're paying too much attention to it. If you're saying something is unacceptable, it means I will not accept it. He said that about Pepe, and yet something similar happens now with Xhaka this time. I mean, he didn't absolutely hammer Xhaka after the game, but he did say that. He didn't defend him either.
No. It's not a good sign, is it, when players are getting sent off every other week? When I think back, though, to Arsenal, and I consider that Arsenal to be at their apex around the turn of the century under Arsene Wenger, they used to have a lot of sendings off back then, but that was mostly a reflection of how much Arsenal wanted to win games. But if you compare those sort of Patrick Vieira sendings off or Emmanuel Petit, there were 30 or 40 of them back then. If you compare those to the sendings off of Xhaka and Pepe, those were just straight petulance and not anti-competitive, but just silly, indisciplined almost by definition. The point that that Dion referred to, Mesut Ozil, Arteta came into the club and showed his hand of being a hard man, a guy willing to make decisions in excommunicating Mesut Ozil. And actually, at the same time, he revived the career of Xhaka. Xhaka was a player that, say you'd spoken a year ago to Arsenal fans, they would have said, get this guy out of the club. But to be fair, Xhaka did play some decent football under Arteta, I should say. But this ruthlessness, I'm not sure it works, because Xhaka eventually has reverted back to type, which is that of an indisciplined, not particularly decent midfield player. And surely, if you've got a player of the quality of Mesut Ozil, you use him when you can, and you show him who's boss. Now,
are you serious, though, John? I mean, are you saying if you were in Mikel Arteta's position, you would now say, I was wrong about you, Ozil, you can come back to the team? And would Arteta not have to add at the end of that, and I'll show myself out?
Well, I mean, think of the way that good managers operate this. Think of Manchester City with Carlos Tevez a few years back. There was that massive falling out with Roberto Mancini, And eventually there was a rapprochement between them. Tevez contributed to Manchester City winning the league. Alex Ferguson, you know, the master, would make sure that if a player was causing him trouble, he would get his use out of him and then he would cut him dead. He did that with, well, you could name a big list of them, but I suppose it started with, say, Paul Ince and Mark Hughes, you know, went through to Roy Keane. Someone who has control of a team, has control of a club, is able to do that and make a player want to play for him. The impression you get from Ozil and this social media account that he may or may not run is that Ozil thinks this whole thing is funny. And it casts a bad smell over the club, having a player who is still the highest earning player not playing, and particularly when he's exactly what the team needs.
What do you think, Dion? I mean, do you think it's time to eat an enormous truckload of humble pie for Mikel Arteta?
Ozil's never had, this is the most productive he's been in an Arsenal shirt. He's turning into Dennis Bergkamp. The way people are now looking at him as saying he's a solution. And I understand it, but I think it also underlines the kind of half the job. And okay, he's only been there a year, but half the job Mikel Arteta has done in all these things. Like he is a master. And from the beginning, it was like, okay, here's a tough guy. He's going to take no shit, and he's going to everything is unacceptable, and things are he's going to really be, there's going to be no more of the kind of, if you look back to the late Arsene Wenger era where everything seemed to be tolerated, that is what Arteta looked like he was going to just reverse. But at the same time, and one of the problems is that he has exiled Ozil, but for lots of different reasons, Ozil's still at the club. So he remains this, just put him in the team, just get him back. Now, obviously, if he'd left, he'd still be facing, if Arsenal were in this position, people would be saying, why have you sold Mesut Ozil? But perhaps, and this would be the gamble, perhaps he would be at another club where he would be performing as Ozil has actually performed for Arsenal. And people would be saying, oh, this is why he's not at the club. Because I agree with a lot of what John is saying, especially at the pragmatic way managers like Ferguson, obviously, and Mancini dealt with those situations. But those players, Tevez in particular, Tevez was just a player who was difficult, but when you got him on the pitch, he was actually useful.
When John said about Tevez, I was thinking to myself, but that Tevez thing didn't last this long, and I just went and checked it, and actually Tevez was out of the squad for like 6 months. It started off in September, I guess, and then he was just not in the squad. October, November, December, January, February. Eventually comes back in at the end of. At the end of March, for the run in, that was it. Like, so he actually was out pretty much as long as Ozil has been now. I was thinking there's no way they can climb down from this, but actually they, I think the difference though is that what Tevez had done was like this blatant sort of public insubordination, like just a blatant falling out with Mancini that everyone was like, oh, you can't really do that. You know what I mean? Like, what does he expect when you do that? They'd had this big fight. Whereas what Ozil has done has been more mysterious, but it's clearly related to the pay cut. You know what I mean? Everyone keeps denying, oh, it's not just about the pay cut. And Ozil was like, I wasn't the only one, by the way. But it clearly did come from that incident. After then he wasn't playing.
But it's also that he doesn't have, okay, he has some beautiful moments as an Arsenal player, but there is, you can make a case that Arsenal needed for a number of years, they needed a team that wasn't carrying a player in so many situations, the way Arsenal were carrying a team with Ozil in it. So that's the slight difference. There are actually, it's almost more like an Irish situation with like Trapattoni and Andy Reid or something, where Trapattoni has decided this player isn't what I'm never going to pick a player like this. This player has no role for me in the way I want to play football. And now if there are other circumstances which I can then hang that on, that's fine, but I could also just use him as an example of what I don't want from a footballer. And that's, I think, there were obviously factors too, but I think that's what Arteta should have been working towards. But instead, because Ozil is still there, and Xhaka being an example, because there are now just these inconsistencies in it, it ends up creating a sense of weakness, whatever he decides to do.
John, what do you think of the punditry of Patrice Evra at the moment? Are you a fan?
Yes, I am a fan, yes.
Oh, really? You like this? I mean, straight shooting doesn't even begin to describe what he's doing at the moment. The latest,
slash and burn.
Slash and burn. The latest being just taking private conversations with Thierry Henry and airing them on Sky Sports.
Well, what was it, Neil Young? It's better to burn out than it is to rust. I mean, the career's not...
That's absolutely Patrice Evra's punditry philosophy.
Yeah, he's not going to last long, but let's enjoy it while we can. I mean, I imagine if you're the producer on Sky, a lot of words are had with Patrice over his lack of discretion. But that's gold, really. It's fantastic. It's also... We assume that it's true.
It's clearly not true.
I mean, he's gotten one spectacularly wrong already this season, which they had to apologise for.
Yes, let's not go into that. But
it didn't sound plausible, this Thierry Henry story, I have to say.
But I think it sounded like he created a better story out of quite a mundane incident, which we've all had. You know, come round and watch the football, and then you find, you know, and you end up.
Henry's like, oh, not this dickhead again, and then but they continue to watch the game and everyone just
but it's on in the background while they talk about, you know,
do you like it as well, Dion? We were talking to Rory Smith last week about the super fan turned pundit, which has become increasingly popular in recent times. Do you think Ever is a welcome addition to this canon?
I think it is just enjoy him while he's here, while he still has friendships to betray and sort of indiscretions to reveal. Like, I think it's you know, I think it's Henri's. Like, it is perhaps the most interesting incident involving former Sky Sports pundit Thierry Henry that's actually took place on Sky Sports, because he never managed to be this interesting when he was sitting there himself. So that was quite an achievement too. But it's going to be interesting how he... I thought it was quite funny too that when David Jones issued the kind of...
Of course, Thierry Henry isn't here to confirm.
Ever then respond, I'm not a liar.
It's always, I've been in this situation presenting, it's always the danger when you do the qualifier that you sort of have to do. The person who then is shooting from the lip doubles down on what they're saying. It can be a dicey old business. Let's talk about Liverpool Spurs on Wednesday night. I'll start with Tottenham, because I thought Jose was... After the game against Palace, he's talking about how I warned the players, you know, they basically we have to put Palace away because otherwise they're going to stick balls in the box and eventually they'll fluke a goal. So in defence of my beloved Crystal Palace these days, John, I would say they seem to be... Now, I didn't get to watch this game live, so maybe I'm being hoodwinked by the Match of the Day 2 analysis last night, but it looked, judging by that, that Palace played some great stuff and thoroughly deserved to take points off Tottenham.
Well, Palace are a decent team. Roy Hodgson, as he does, of teams of a certain... standing, is doing a good job there, and the team is not just about Wilfred Zaha anymore. There are other players involved in the team. So, as it turned out for Tottenham, it wasn't a terrible result, was it? So, Tottenham didn't exactly set up with all guns blazing, with the swagger of a team that you think they're going to win the title. I mean, you saw Hjoberg after the game talk about how we're the team to beat now because... we're top of the league, but they didn't really play like that. But then again, this is a Jose Mourinho team, and I suppose they're sticking to the formula of the later part of his career. I think we may look upon that as a decent result for Tottenham in the end, but because I think Palace are always dangerous at the moment.
Liverpool obviously didn't manage to make up any points there. Dion, this is caught cold really by Fulham. Particularly in the first half hour of the game. But, you know, this is part of an increasingly familiar pattern with them. Like, their away record this season is terrible. So, one win in six matches. For this one, I mean, Jurgen Klopp obviously was doing a lot of jumping up and down, shouting on the sideline and so on. He's done a lot of crying about the schedule and all this kind of thing. And then he plays someone like Diogo Jota in a game that he doesn't need to really play in and loses him for 6 to 8 weeks. What's the logic there?
I don't know. I think it's, I don't know. There is no real explanation for the Jota selection because it was a game that meant nothing. Even in their injury crisis, Liverpool can find somebody to cover that for them without risking a player who has been kind of central to everything this season. So
it's a real disaster for them because, you know, not only because they lose Jota, who's been playing so well, but if you look at it, Mane and Firmino's been kind of struggling for a while. It seems like Mane has not scored in 8 matches now. And looks a bit sluggish, which is not surprising considering he's played like a game every 3 days for like the last 5 years. The guy who was brought in to cover for Andy Robertson is now also going to be out for Christmas. So Robertson, another player who literally seems to be playing football match every time you turn on the TV, is now going to have to play another sort of 11 games in 7 days or whatever it is over the Christmas and New Year period.
Yeah, no, it's it does seem like it's very hard for Liverpool to kind of get out of this, and whether there is some element of it in terms of Klopp's own exasperation with the situation. The away form thing is kind of interesting because, you know, this season home and away with behind closed doors, for most clubs, it isn't having that much of an impact because there isn't really a difference. There shouldn't be a difference between if you look back, the reason home teams get a benefit when they're at home is not because of the players themselves, but the referees tend to be influenced by home supporters, and that's gone. Although Fulham actually yesterday had some kind of an atmosphere, but it would suggest that kind of sense Liverpool have of being on the kind of endless treadmill is affecting them because they're on the road again. They're off somewhere else where they've got to kind of haul themselves onto the pitch, try not to get injured, and then also deal with teams who are going to lift their game against the champions. So I do think that the combination of the injuries and Klopp's reaction to the injuries in some way are just creating a sense, and I think possibly also in the opponents, is creating a sense that this team is vulnerable. Because they seem, there's the whole narrative is that they're tired, and it's encouraging teams like Fulham, who really, if Liverpool were at the top of their game, wouldn't stand a chance.
What do you reckon, John, on Liverpool?
I share similar thoughts to Dion. I think Jurgen Klopp on the sidelines, he's always had this sort of frenzied persona, but. It's usually shared with a bit of enjoyment and occasionally a detachment, which means he sees through the ridiculousness of it all. But I don't think he's doing that at the moment. He really does not seem to be enjoying himself. And that's strange, isn't it, for a team that were title winners after such a after such a long time. It's been a real slog for Liverpool, and the factors are... Obviously, the factors are no different for most teams that, if you're involved in European football. But he seems to have taken it personally, and he's involved himself in running battles with the likes of Des Kelly.
Chris Wilder.
I think he's winning that one. And also, there was a VAR whinge yesterday. He's taken up against VAR. Hey, listen, this is what successful managers do in the end. Eventually, everybody is their enemy. It certainly was the case with Ferguson, Wenger, definitely Jose Mourinho. So maybe this is, no more sunshine boy from Jurgen Klopp. This is what it takes to be a winner. But Liverpool look so much more fragile than they did last season, so much more.
When you looked at the... I guess you probably... we're watching the Manchester Derby.
Oh, God.
Sorry, nobody wants to talk about it. I'll just a quick one. Is this, when you think back to that game, was this a case of, I think Gary Neville said, we shouldn't accept that. I don't know what he's suggesting we do. Like, you're supposed to write to your MP if you're over there, like, this is just not good enough. This game was not of this standard that I require. I mean, it obviously didn't come up to standard, but was this a case of teams, could you see any excuses for that? I don't want to sit here and necessarily make excuses for 20 million a year Pep Guardiola, but like, I don't know. It seemed to me watching this game that like he could have tried to go and win the game, but that would have risked losing it, and that just wouldn't have been worth it in the circumstances. Actually, a draw is, as we can see from the results this weekend, draw is not a bad result at all.
No. And of course, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said it was the best performance in his time at Manchester United. So good luck with that, Ole. No one else knows what you're talking about there.
Well, I mean, in the sense, he could say they only had one chance, the Mahrez chance, really. I can't remember any other chances that City had in the game. So that was good.
But that doesn't really speak to the ambitions of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as a manager, does it? And actually, thinking about Pep Guardiola, when he came to English football, there was this, he held this idea. It was almost a pretension, this idea of, I'm going to do things my way, and my way is to play football as I want it. You know, what is tackles, that type of thing. Yet, 4.5 years on or so, he's resorting to the type of English football which is, when you go away to a big rival, you don't give up too much, and you play Fernandinho and Rodri in midfield, and you lock it down and then hope to nick a goal. I mean, that game, as Manchester derbies go, I think that's, it took me back to the days of when, say, early Alex Ferguson, and who would be the City manager back then? I don't know, Howard Kendall, Mel Machin, someone like that.
Frank Clark.
Yeah, well,
it's maybe too late.
That was a bit too late. Yeah, where you sort of, you've got Mike Phelan chugging round midfield for United, and you've got, Colin Hendry in City's defence, and Neil McNabb or something like that. It was so underamped, so low in quality. And yet you peel through both of those teams and they've got some great attacking players, yet neither manager wanted their players to do that. Both of them seemed to get what they wanted out of it, which is not what anyone else wanted. It was absolutely terrible.
Tweet here, Dion, from Paul Howard, saying, seriously, this is the worst Premier League season I can ever remember. It's understandable, but it's terrible. We seem to be taking umbrage with a lot of Paul Howard tweets lately for some reason. Nothing personal. We do very much like Paul. But what do you think? I mean, is it that bad? I kind of like the unpredictability. I guess the issue is that earlier on this season, the unpredictability was manifested in goal fests and shocks involving loads of goals being scored and that kind of thing, which hasn't happened as much in the last few weeks. And in fairness, there were a couple of really bad games. I mean, Saturday, there was a lot of bad football played on Saturday. But as a whole, is the unpredictability of it not making it actually more exciting than some previous seasons?
No, I think the unpredictability is a good thing. I think it can be bad and also unpredictable. So there's a point, there's validity to that point. I also do think, in general, everyone is just kind of weary now. And like Saturday's game is a very good example, because it reminded me, it was worse than all of these, but it reminded me of a lot of kind of Liverpool United games in kind of recent years. Like a couple of the Mourinho games, there's one at Anfield, which was very like that. But at least you had, the problem with that game is you turn it on, and there is nothing to disguise the fact how terrible it is, because there's no crowd. There's nothing to, if there's a full house there, then there's a tackle, there's an incident that actually becomes something contentious because of the reaction of the supporters. And you don't have that. You don't have those distractions. And instead, you're just left. Again, it's just too much reality. You're just face to face with this terrible game. And I think that people find that wearing at this point in everyone's lives in lockdown and in various forms of lockdown, that's kind of a tough thing to put up with. But I don't, I think the unpredictability of it actually is, when you look at the table, you look at Arsenal, you look at the situation in general, it's quite exciting. So I think it's quite bad. I think the players are exhausted. I think there's nothing. There's very little for them to feed off. And I think going back to Liverpool, and what John's point about Liverpool winning the league and then they're going into this season, I think the circumstances of that are kind of, could be a factor too, because they won the league for the first time in 30 years. There's very little.
It's like right now, do it again.
Yeah, right now, do it again. And you've had nothing, you've had no adrenaline, you haven't basked in the acclaim of a million grateful people on the streets of Liverpool. You've had great performance at the start of the season. A friend of mine in Liverpool texted me, early on in the season this year, after the Arsenal game, I think it was, and he said, the greatest Liverpool team in history, and nobody can see it. And that sense of just, you know, it's just drudgery. You're working almost a 9-to-5 job, a very well-paid 9-to-5 job, but you're doing that. I think that is a factor too for Liverpool, because they just have to do it again without any of the kind of adrenaline rush. But also, I think it also is a factor for everybody. And I do, you know, the few games we've had, you know, with crowds, especially in some grounds, has elevated things a little bit. And so that maybe is in Britain and in England, as 2021 goes on, that'll be something that will actually elevate the season again and make it kind of more substantial.
Yeah, we'll see. In the meantime, I'll just be following Paul Harrod's Twitter feed to see what we can disagree with next week. Listen, that's great stuff, Dion. John, thanks a million.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
Sport is a great thing, Pádraig, and especially hurling, our sport, the greatest sport that was ever played by any man. They're getting their award today, mixed with this brilliant blend of youth, fire and enthusiasm, and so thrilled for them. Clareman, rivals of ours all our lives. But you know, the Cranberries go up around Crow Park. Dolores, one of their own, Pádraig. Magic, magic moment for them.
Well, it's a highly emotional...
Oh no, my stomach is burning here, lads. I tell you, oh dear.
Who's going to win it, guys?
Limerick.
Excuse me?
Dowler! On your fire!
He didn't go to bloody onion bag after backing it in. He went to place it to the corner.
Limerick are on the brink of a historic breakthrough at Croke Park.
Limerick better wake up here, because Galway are back in the game big time.
Cruised into the top of the nation. Is there any end to the drama? Is there any end to the drama,
Pádraig? And Galway are within one of Limerick.
It's hard to watch.
Oh, man, I don't know what to say here.
Could he possibly, from 2-3 metres outside his own 45, the greatest sport that was ever played by any man?
That's a massive ask.
If you wanted one man in the history of hurling to hit it for you, you might want it to be Joe Kenning.
I think the long wait is over.
How long is it again to wait?
Well, since 2007.
Well, 1973 is the last time they won.
Limerick have it! Limerick are coming away with it!
Yeah! On,
if the rest of the world only knew about this sport, this is incredible.
Limerick have beaten Galway! Woo! 1973! And today, 2000...
Well, the scenes weren't quite as emotional at Croke Park yesterday, Murph. There's less of a sense of watching a team lift the weight of history from their shoulders as they did back in 2018. It was more watching a team who are in the business of creating their own history. No All-Irelands... I tried this earlier on and failed miserably, so what I was trying to say earlier was no All-Irelands in nearly half a century before that famous day in 2018. Now they have two in 3 years. I mentioned haters. I mean, it's not quite at that level yet, but I noticed there's a little bit of cribbing about the fact that these guys seem to foul their way through matches without... It's the same thing the All Blacks get, Murph, that the referees seem to be very lenient towards them. I'm not trying to drag Limerick people down here. I'm not saying it's like eating shite off a scabby leg or anything.
No, you wouldn't say that.
No, I wouldn't say that. I think they're a joy to watch, but I'm just saying one more on Ireland next year and there will be plenty of haters.
Yeah, they were absolutely brilliant yesterday though. I mean, you're probably talking about one of the great All-Ireland final performances. Oh my god, just the way that they took the emotion out of it, like so clinical with the ball, so efficient with the ball, like some unbelievable personal displays. Yeah, we'll get into it all tomorrow on the show with Jamie Wall and Michael Dogden, as you said earlier on. But yeah, I'd be interested to hear what the lads thought, because I thought it was like ridiculous, scary.
Okay.
Scary good.
Scary indeed. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Owen. And thank you, Ciarán.
Okay, thanks, guys. And remember, to hear coverage of that hurling and to hear us talking about all the Premier League games during the week, you will have to be a member. So sign up now if you haven't already done so. secondcaptains.com/join. See you later.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.